Great. Sensational. Terrific. What is it?
I told you.
Science. Crimeology.
Are you with me?
Not exactly with you, but somewhere nearby.
Oh.
This is Cybercrimeology, a podcast about cybercrime, its research, and its researchers. My name is Michael, and I am really interested in what it is that moves people to prepare themselves against cybercrime. Around the world, there are campaigns that aim to make us more cybersecure. But what are those campaigns actually doing to improve our behavior? Our guest today is Dr. Tommy von Stein, who is Assistant Professor in Cybersecurity Governance at the Institute of Security and Global Affairs at Leiden University. With colleagues, he's recently produced a paper titled, What, If Any, Behavior Change Techniques Do Government-Led Cybersecurity Awareness Campaigns Use? They apply a behavior change technique taxonomy to such campaigns from around the world. If I'm going to be honest, it's probably easier to understand that if you read the paper. But to get a taste, I asked Dr. von Stein to analyze a video produced by the Canadian Revenue Agency, which I think is a great example of cybersecurity messaging done well. We will also have an expert to answer my stupid questions. Dominic Vogel is a cybersecurity consultant from cyber.sc, and he's kindly agreed to answer my silly and potentially irritating questions over the next few weeks so that you can be one step ahead the next time you meet a cybersecurity consultant at a dinner party. First though, let's jump into the conversation with Dr. Tommy von Stein. His background is in psychology, so of course that begged the question of how does one start in psychology and make their way into cybersecurity and cybercrime research?
Sometimes just life happens, basically, right? So I did a general bachelor in psychology, and then you do the whole broadness of the field, right? Including also developmental and organizational, but also clinical psychology, of course. And I was already more attracted to the more social psychology side of kind of the behavior, you could say, of just everyday people. Why do we behave the way we do, and how does that all work? And then I moved into behavioral change, because it was quite interesting. So what influences behavior? And it's strange how the way we frame a message or what we present people with can actually have an effect on what they do either later in life or at that point in time. And after my PhD, I was looking for a postdoc, and finding one took quite a while. And my former professor for my PhD had moved to a different university and said, hey, I've got some projects I could use your help on. I've got some money left, so why not come here and work for a while? And that kind of stayed for a bit. And there were some more cybersecurity related projects going on there. So that's how it more broadly started in that topic. Then when applying for jobs after that postdoc, of course, you think, okay, either another postdoc or an assistant professorship somewhere. Broadly in psychology would have been fine, but also, you know, something with cybersecurity would be interesting. Hence, when I found a job and they enjoyed the idea of working more on that end user psychological behavioral side, because in the group where I'm currently in, we already had more on the legal side and the international politics side. So it's nice to have the whole chain where possible in your own research group, basically.
Do you find that it's easy to work together? Like, I mean, I don't want to say anything. Some of my best friends have legal degrees. Does it work out well coming for being a psychologist, talking to lawyers and I assume some computer scientists?
Yeah, I think it works quite well in the sense that I think there's two ways of looking at it, right? When you get into a group like this, that means you're an interdisciplinary group, and that's great, because it means that you can look at all kinds of problems in society through different lenses, kind of a way you can actually work together where you're investigating something. Hey, it's interesting to see what other people might think of this from a different background, but also can we work together and make more collaborative effort, because they're already there rather than you having to find them in a whole different department and hope they might want to be interested in doing something with cybersecurity. So that's a good thing. I think the downside on any interdisciplinary group is always that because you're the expert in your field, you also need to deliver, and you don't have a lot of sparring partners within your department from the same background necessarily, right? And that goes for all of us. We all are kind of the one person in that field who's working here. And that means that sometimes you have to reach out to other people in other departments or people you worked with in the past if you want to have the more in-depth conversation with each other on a psychological theory or where the field is moving outside of the cybersecurity domain where you apply that knowledge again.
How was it that you came to start looking at the cybersecurity efforts in terms of education coming from government?
As part of a bigger project somewhere, someone in our team promised to look at awareness campaigns more broadly and asked them whether I could do that. And we did a bit of a small report for them and then realized later on, well, if we've done already quite a bit of the work, why not see if we can push it a bit further and turn this into more of a paper, more of an actual scientific publication. And then we went back to what we already had in terms of materials and started looking what else would we basically need, what would be interesting, because we know that governments more and more start relying on behavioral science, but also on evidence-based policy, right? Not always possible, also given this time it takes for that evidence to be found and to be delivered. But where possible, governments and other organizations are trying to do that. So we were trying to see some evidence of that. Can we see how they're making use of what's already out there? If not, okay, so can we say something about what they should be doing, or can we say something about the current kind of level they're at? And that's what we try to do here, is by saying, okay, what is already existing in those awareness campaigns on cybersecurity? What do governments already do? And what does it look like scientifically speaking?
You used the behavior change wheel. And from what I understand, that comes from the behavior change taxonomy version 1 containing 90 something element. I couldn't get my head around the extended version of it, but the behavior change wheel.
Yes. So there's basically all kinds of ways of looking at behavior and behavior change. And one of the ways is a method developed by Susan Michie, together with some other people. She's a professor of behavioral change, I think, still at University College London in the UK. And she basically said, okay, there's all kinds of methods by now to attempt to change people's behavior. And some of these are perhaps more popular or well-known, but we should actually find a way of categorizing those a bit. Because currently, you know, it's all over the place and everyone's just doing something and everyone's also calling perhaps things that are very similar, very differently, which you see in science, right? Where people want to kind of pretend they all find their own new phenomenon or their own new method in terms of behavioral change, but perhaps they're actually not that different. And similarly, the other way around, where people from different departments or different kind of areas of behavioral change use similar wordings for very different techniques. And so she said we need to start standardizing this a bit more. So yes, it's this behavioral change wheel, where basically they say every intervention can be seen as a separate functions, right? Such as education or training, but also, for example, environmental restructuring or restrictions. So it can also be on terms of laws and higher level changes to society, rather than only at the behavioral change, end user behavioral change level. But at that level, they say, okay, we've got some techniques. They are, I think, around 90 or 95. And they define each of those what it is, and then can be used to, for example, look at, we did awareness campaigns and see how they fit that. But also, if you design your own intervention, it's helpful to say exactly how does your intervention work in terms of which of these techniques is it trying to put together. So you see quite a lot of people publishing papers where they then not just only say we did an intervention that trained people to do X, Y, or Z, but actually which of those specific behavioral change techniques did it incorporate under which circumstances, et cetera.
You took that and you used it to sort of see what the current state of education, training, awareness coming from governments in different countries is.
Yeah, exactly. And because we thought there's a range of methods you could use, but we felt this one incorporates a lot of different areas, right? So that makes it easier to see, okay, are there certain areas that are perhaps well represented that we say, okay, yes, you know, they all tick this box, or they all make sure that at least option X, Y, Z is in there. With others, perhaps not so much, or they're missing, or they're not implemented very well. And this gave us a bit of a structure of how to look at these awareness campaign materials, because for every campaign, there are always a lot of materials and you need to find a way of structuring that in a bit of a kind of sensible way.
Can we do that in practice? I'll grab something and we'll have a look at it. You can run through it with me.
Why not? Let's do it. I'm not sure how well it goes on the fly, because normally this happens by kind of multiple people who also then have to have conversations and they might kind of go through the materials multiple times. But yeah, let's look at something and see what we can find.
My tax refund by text?
Don't click it, Mike. It's a scam.
Oh.
So the video is about this voice of reason kind of talking to this person. Person's getting a text, which is seemingly telling them something about the tax refund from, I think, the Canada Revenue Agency. And then the voice of reason says, don't click it, Mike. It's a scam. Normally, we would say, okay, this is already a prompt or a cue, right? That immediately comes up after that message is being received. Now, of course, in real life, you won't have that prompt or cue necessarily. But the idea is that the message itself being sent to you should be also a cue to think about what this ad is calling your voice of reason, to then say, okay, look, think twice before you actually act.
My voice of reason.
You think the Canada Revenue Agency would text you your tax refund?
What you see here is kind of like a conversation, right? That is kind of meant to mimic what your actual conversation inside your head would be like. Okay, well, does this make sense? Are we expecting this, so to say? it's kind of acknowledging the fact that there's a bit of ambiguity here. It's acknowledging that, hey, on the one hand, you get a message that you think is credible. On the other hand, hey, wait, your inner thought process, so to say, is suggesting perhaps there's something wrong here, because would they actually text you, right? Is that a feasible way in which that organization would contact you? And for a lot of organizations, it might be, but kind of the revenue agency says no.
So you think it's kind of encouraging people to consider more information than that is being supplied specifically with that text message?
Yes. And so it's a form of education, you could say, to start thinking, hey, is this the normal way in which I would communicate with this specific authority?
Yeah, the education there is that the Canada Revenue Agency will not send you a text message.
Yeah, exactly. So that's, I think, what they're trying to do here, to get people to realize, hey, if ever they are in touch with you about your tax refund, it won't be via text.
Texting is quite popular.
Come on.
Looks legit.
Don't click. The CRA doesn't text refunds.
So the guy says, don't click, your voice of reason.
Yep.
At the same time, you see the person moving away from that, right? So, of course, with a lot of behaviors, we want people to actively do something, to actively sign up for something, yep, or take part or change their habits. Here it's about not doing something, which is in cybersecurity more often the case, which is always a bit difficult to demonstrate. But here you can see, and this is one of the other ways in which the behavioral change wheel is kind of structured, is saying a demonstration of behavior, right? So you want to demonstrate the correct behavior to people so they know, hey, this is what I should be doing. And linguistically, it's a bit annoying that here's the other way around, that we want someone to not do something. But effectively, the person is throughout this whole video showing that, right? He's not clicking on it first by wanting to do so, but then not doing it because his voice of reason starts talking in the first place. And then again, by having an ongoing conversation, so to say.
So he's demonstrating doing nothing.
Yes. Which is, in a lot of behavioral change projects, that's not the point, is to make people actively do something. But with cyber, you also see that's quite a lot of conversations that say, no, we actually do need people to do nothing, so to say.
Check out their site. Have I ever steered you wrong?
No.
Listen to your voice of reason before you act. Canada.ca/bscamsmart can help. A message from the Government of Canada.
Okay, so what else you see there is a bit of a reminder of a feedback loop, right? Have I ever made you do the wrong thing or something along those lines, right? What's been your past experiences with this specific behavior or with this specific way of thinking? And of course, in the end, there's a bit of a call for authority saying, hey, it's the Government of Canada telling you this, so please trust us and believe us when we say that this is in your best interest. I'm not sure that last bit is something they put in there to be convincing. I'm assuming they also just put it in there to make clear who created this ad, right? And who's sponsoring it and all those kind of things. But it is also one of those behavioral change tactics of saying, okay, we get the authoritative figure here that shows they know what they're talking about, or at least hopefully knows what they're talking about.
Nothing in there was particularly scary. Like it didn't say that he was going to lose all his money or get lung cancer or his teeth were going to fall out or anything like that. And it seemed to be trying to show what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the way that we're heading? Are we moving away from fear messages and fear appeals towards sort of trying to promote more skills?
Yes, I think that's broadly the way we're going, because I think with fear appeals, there's some evidence that they work. There's been a bit of an ongoing discussion on how well they work and are they useful, right? Because you see countries adopting this on cigarette packaging where either there's not very great looking pictures on it or there are texts about, you know, smoking kills, etc. But I think people realize that just scaring people into doing something, especially with cyber, becomes quite problematic because cyber is such a vast domain. It's very difficult for people to realize what should they then be doing. Right. And with smoking and perhaps with speeding or driving without a seatbelt, it's a very clear good, bad form of behavior. You know what you should be doing. You know what you're doing currently. And so you can see where there's a difference between the two. But with cyber, that's a lot more difficult because you don't see necessarily all the mistakes you might make. And just being secure in one area doesn't mean you're in other areas as well. Or just because you don't click on one of those text messages doesn't mean you won't fall for an email scam, for example, or someone who actually calls you up. So I think they are moving a bit more, and that's a good thing. They're moving a bit more towards skills and capabilities rather than only on this is going to be very scary and hopefully you'll be frightened.
So based on what you were able to determine from the current state of cybersecurity messaging, what are some things that as a community of people designing these messages could we be doing better?
Well, I think so. If you look, for example, at the video we've just watched, right, I think it's good in the sense that it's very clear that don't click on any text messages that pretend to come from the Canada Revenue Agency because we don't text you. I'm not sure whether that's the whole goal they had, but if that's the goal they had, I think the message is very clear. And it kind of sends out a clear example of, hey, the text message might look like this, you know, use your voice of reason and don't act upon it. So I think that's very good. The slight downside, of course, is that you would have to do this for every type of cyber threat you could see that has a human element in it. And that number is fast, right? So it would be perhaps better, or kind of a next step is to say, okay, what are people going to think when they see this video? So they know now, okay, I shouldn't click on a text message from this agency because they don't communicate that way. But the video doesn't, for example, say how they do communicate, right? They don't give an extra information of, okay, so when do you respond to this tax revenue? Is it always a letter sent to your home address, for example? Might they communicate via email? I kind of don't think so, but you never know. Do they have like an online environment that you have already a password and a username or some account for, in which you can see those messages, that maybe the government does communicate that way, for example, and that an email might still be sent saying you've got a new message there? That, so it's a bit unclear for people probably. Okay, they don't text, but how do they communicate with us?
Right, yeah.
And of course, I think this was a 30-second video, right? And if it's broadcasted everywhere, you can't get into too much detail. But I think what you see is that either awareness campaigns don't do anything very useful. This one, I think, does, but it's limited in its scope because of the time and the effort that people will have when watching it. So the message has to be very clear and short, which this one definitely does well, I think.
A lot of campaigns really focus on awareness. The goal is behavior change, right?
I would assume so, normally, yeah.
We would hope so. Yes. We want people to learn about these things and then stop doing the things that put them into harm's way.
Exactly.
So awareness is one thing, behavior change is another thing. Is there a link between those two things, or should we be perhaps thinking differently about just making people aware?
The approach of awareness campaigns broadly is something I think should be rethought or kind of improved upon. And this is also where I think behavioral science really has a big role to play, or can kind of contribute to solving at least part of the issue, is that from a behavioral science perspective, there are all kinds of models to figure out what causes a certain behavior to occur, right? And they're all a bit different in kind of which factors they include, but broadly it has something to do about your own feelings, opinions, usually something around those of others, and something around whether you feel capable and or whether the environment allows you to do so, right? And also with cyber, right, it can also be that perhaps your workload is so high that you just don't have time to do all the official checks when you reply to an email and you kind of just go on with it. And whenever we look at all those forms of behavioral models on what causes a certain behavior to occur, awareness is not part of that, right? Because we consider awareness more of a perhaps a perception later on that this topic might be relevant or might be important or of some interest. And that's quite far removed in behavioral models from the actual behavior, because there's all these other factors around what your feelings are, your opinions, what other people find, et cetera, et cetera. And so as a result, the direct link that sometimes implicitly seems to be there in awareness campaigns, where people just assume as long as we make people aware that this is an important issue, it will automatically be solved. That link I don't have much trust in, so to say. So I think we need to look a bit broader, as we talked about earlier, about capabilities, skills, training people that they don't just know what they should be doing, but also how to perform that behavior, and look a bit closer into other factors that also play a role in why people currently aren't doing so. And the slightly tedious task here is that you would have to test that for every separate behavior individually, not because we like redoing that work 25,000 times, but mostly because every behavior has their own specific set of predictors, their own specific set of factors that play a role, right? And so usually you use those behavioral models as a good framework, but you perhaps, depending on the specific behavior, start adding or subtracting some of those factors, thinking, hey, they don't really apply in this case, or perhaps additional factors do apply. And I don't think awareness hurts in that sense. I think it's relevant that people are aware of cyber risks, but I think we need more than that to have lasting and meaningful behavioral change.
What have you got planned next? Is your next step to start going through all of those behaviors, or is there something else that's grabbed your time?
Going through all those behaviors would be great. And there's still some idea in the back of my mind of maybe, like you have a behavioral change taxonomy, maybe we need a similar one for deconstructing human behavior cyber threats. new kind of ways of scams come up every couple of months, where suddenly a new scam is becoming very popular, sadly, by some scammers to get money out of people or get some login details of them, etc. And I wonder whether they are actually new ones or whether they are just rehashes of existing ones with perhaps some tweaks to make them more successful, so to say. So I think it would be interesting to do a bit more on that if I can find some money and time somewhere to engage in those things. And furthermore, we're looking more into, for example, training of end users. So can we set up training to really kind of get people to behave more securely? And then one of the biggest issues is, of course, how do we measure the effectiveness of that? And where do you intervene? So do you intervene at the end user level, who then suddenly has to change their behavior? Or do you intervene at the level of how the system is designed so that almost automatically people are more likely to behave securely, or that certain behavioral change interventions can be implemented in the design process of the software people use or the apps people use?
I look forward to it. Well, thanks very much for your time, and continue. Keep on researching.
Thanks for having me, and enjoy your day.
Now, if you're involved in cyber, you're often expected to answer questions on everything from the difference between CISC and RISC processes to whether the lawnmower man now lives in the metaverse. The best way to get ahead of those wild questions is to ask an expert. We happen to have cornered one on cybersecurity consulting. Dominic Vogel is a founder and chief strategist of Cyber.sc, a Canadian cybersecurity consulting firm, and a co-host of a weekly podcast called Cybersecurity Matters. Mr. Vogel is, among other things, a nice guy and is very willing to answer my potentially stupid questions. So let's take advantage of that and ask him this.
When do people call you? Do they call you before they have a problem, or do they call you after they've had some kind of cybersecurity issue?
I would prefer they call me before, but I'm going to say 95% of the time they call us after. So whether that be after a security breach, whether that be after data is stolen, whether that be after ransomware, more and more we're seeing that they get sent a security questionnaire by an important customer or client. And they have no idea how to fill it out or realize that they're not doing 95% of what's in that questionnaire. It's predominantly reactive. Like I said, as a practitioner, I wish we could be more proactive. But the small and mid-sized business scene being what it is right now, it is highly reactive when it comes to cybersecurity.
What can you do to help them at that point?
When we help them at that point, really it is still focusing on being able to make something achievable or mature their cybersecurity capability. So if it's like after a data breach or after ransomware, we look at root causes. Why did this happen, right? Whether that be technological, policy, or people level failures, right? We really start with a lessons learned approach and say, okay, here's the contributing reasons that led to this happening. We're now going to map this back to what we believe are good industry frameworks that you can at least start mapping out your cybersecurity maturity. So you reduce the likelihood of this happening again. And if it does happen, lower the impact as well, right? So sort of a build back better approach from that perspective. Those that reach out for help with questionnaires, an example, many of them, A, don't know how to answer those types of questions, or B, realize that they don't have many of the things that are being asked for. We guide them through that process and A, how to respond to them, but more importantly, how to start building out that secure program so they don't feel compelled to lie on the questionnaire.
Big thank you again to Dr. Tommy von Stein for his time and running through that CRA video with me. We both agreed that it was a good example of awareness messaging, that they dealt very well with the limitations of the format. If you were involved in the creation of that, I'd of course love to hear from you, so do get in touch. And if you want to see the video as well, there are of course links to be found in the show notes. Also, a big thank you to Dominic Vogel, and he'll be back next episode to answer another question for us, but in the meantime, this has been Cybercrimeology, a podcast about cybercrime, its research, and its researchers. It's produced by me, but it's really only made possible by the kind guests who share their time and their research. You can find out more about the show at cybercrimeology.com. You can talk to me at Cybercrimeology on Twitter.